Hello everyone, this is M.R. Rangaswamy with Indie Aspera Radio. Today I'm joined by Arun Venugopal. He's the host and creator of Micropolis. It's a series produced by WNYC covering race, gender, and ethnicity. It's a very wide-ranging series in its approach. It's examined the meaning of turbans in post-9/11 America, looked at the $20 billion global skin lightener market, and also discussed the pros and cons of ethnic enclaves. He's a regular contributor to NPR's Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and On the Media. He's also appeared on PBS NewsHour and one of my favorite shows, Countdown with Keith Olbermann. He's published articles in The Guardian, The Wall Street Journal, and Salon, and his commentary on Indian American issues has appeared in The New York Times and many other publications. He frequently serves as an MC and a moderator for discussions on race, religion, and identity issues. Arun previously wrote for India Abroad and served as an India at a multi-faith website, BeliefNet. He lives with his family in Queens, New York. Welcome, Arun.
Thank you, MR. Thanks a lot for having me.
Hey, great to have you on the show. You look like one interesting guy, so I want to jump in.
Sure.
Kind of get an understanding, you know, did you come over from India? Were you born in the U.S.? What was your growing up and childhood like?
Yeah, I was born in the U.S. My parents moved here in, I think it might have been January 1st, 1970, to the U.S. They came via Scotland. My dad had been in the Indian Army, served as a doctor in the Indian Army, at some point realized that basically these opportunities to advance himself weren't really adequate, and so he kind of hit a wall, realized he had to sort of support his big family, siblings, parents, and all that, and wanted to sort of also advance his career, and so they decided to finally move abroad. They moved to Scotland at the time when a lot of people were moving to the UK, I guess. But then they decided to go further west. They landed up in Washington, D.C., lived there for a couple years. And one of my sisters was born there. They already had my oldest sister had been born in India. So they had two girls, and they moved eventually to Connecticut, where I was born. And a few days after that, they moved down to Texas and settled down in Houston, which is where they still live, actually. But so that's my story. I grew up mostly in Texas, but with a couple stints back and forth to India as well.
Awesome. So you are a classic immigrant story. So your parents, you know, your dad was a doctor, so you grew up and in the U.S., so how come you didn't become a doctor?
Yeah, well, it wasn't for lack of everybody else trying to make sure I became a doctor, that's for sure. I think... you know, I'm like all the rest, right? You're like, oh, well, I guess I know what I'm going to be when I grow up. And I kind of bought into it. I was, every couple of years, I'd change the specialty, the medical specialty I was going to go into when I was like 8 or 10, you know, it was one thing. And then eventually it was another. And then finally I was like, oh, I think I'll be an ophthalmologist. And, you know, this is high school. And my dad was like, oh, that's a great field. Ophthalmology is awesome. You know, totally you should go into ophthalmology. And I was like, all right, I love eyes. I mean, who doesn't love great eyes, you know? It's like these kinds of things that you – and not quite realizing that, you know, on the science front, I really wasn't anything special. You know, I was always kind of slightly struggling in those subjects. And then I got to college, and I went to college in San Antonio. It's called Trinity University. Mm-hmm. It's a liberal arts university in San Antonio. I think by the end of the first semester, I was like, wow, this stuff is really hard, and I'm doing really bad in these subjects. And that's when I remember hearing my friends saying, like, why are you kidding yourself like this? You know, like you know, there was a level of denial, self-denial, like, you know, of my saying, well, I'm just not very good at this. And they're like, well, is it that, or is it just that you don't want to do it? You don't like it, you know? It took me a little while before I realized that I wasn't really meant to follow that path. And of course, it was a bit of a bombshell for my parents. They were just really worried that, like, you know, where's their son going there? I think it was more not really a sense of anger or anything like that, but a sense that, you know, of just not knowing where my path would lead. And, you know, it got even worse the next year when I told him, so I'm going to major in religion. Now, looking back on that, I feel a little sad for them because, you know, they must have been like, oh, no, we've lost him.
Oh, my God. And, and we're, you know, we saved up for this guy's college education and we're paying for his...
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and it's not like I was, you know, first couple years of college, I wasn't even doing that well academically. I mean, I was really into it. You know, I really did enjoy the subject matter and classes and just the whole experience, you know, in the classroom and outside of the classroom. But I think with some reason, I guess they were like, oh, my gosh, what's going on? And especially when you come home and you say, you know, it's not really about the classes. It's really about the experience of meeting people and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And they're like, oh, great. You know, this guy's completely goofing off. And and it wasn't exactly the case. I was actually, like, you know, getting involved in various things like student government. I joined a comedy and improv troupe. So I was involved in that. And that was, you know, it was some of the biggest sort of thrills of my life were standing up on stage and trying to be funny for a really pretty big audience and getting that kind of feedback. And so, you know, those kinds of things were pretty formative, I think. I did sort of my religion advisor actually told me, and actually he and I have exchanged some emails recently. It's kind of nice to stay in touch with your old, you know, the people who are so influential. And he told me at the time, he's like, listen, why don't you take on another subject as well, something a little more practical than religion. And he's saying this as a religion professor who's, you know, his expertise is like the history of like ancient Indian religions and Hinduism and all that. And he was the one who got me kind of excited and interested in Indian culture, Hinduism. But he was basically kind of empathetic and he understood where my parents were probably coming from. So sort of as a gesture to them and to him, I went ahead and decide, well, I guess communications is something maybe I can tolerate. And so I did that, although I had no interest at the time in going to journalism. So you
get out of college, I guess, with, you know, a major in religion and communications, whatever, right? And then how the heck did you get into media? Did you start right away trying to be a copy editor, a writer, or
actually, Well, my religion major really got me excited about the study of cultures. I did have sort of a, I guess, a spiritual bent, and I was intrigued by what I was studying in my Hinduism class, Buddhism, Taoism, these kinds of different subjects. But it was more about the study of how, like, you know, people kind of come together and they have these kinds of, you know, they formulate, you know, common customs and religious beliefs and philosophies. I just found all these kinds of things very interesting, as well as the frictions that you see happening between religions. And, you know, I studied, I guess my senior thesis in college was about the Kashmir issue and the history of that, and also studied things about what was happening at that time in college, which was like the Babri Masjid issue and, you know, what was happening there. And I remember, you know, my parents would get to India Today, so I'd go home and, you know, see the, you know, that coverage on the front, on the cover, and try to bring that into my academic life. But, you know, I guess practically speaking, I didn't have any sense of or interest in going to, say, academia. I knew that wasn't really for me. But what I did was, I said, you know, I just want to go to India and do something there. And my dad was like, okay, so what do you want to do there? I was like, well, you know, advertising is something I've been kind of dabbling in. And I tried to get an internship or two during college and ad agencies in Houston. And so we have a cousin. I have a cousin who's his name is Rajiv Menon, and he's been the director of a couple films, as well as the DP, the cinematographer for a couple of Mani Ratnam's films. So he was in that world, and he was also making a lot of ad, you know, commercials. And so he kind of encouraged me, yeah, why don't you come here? I can connect you with some of the ad agencies here if you want to spend a few months and then go back. And so straight after college, I landed up in Bangalore, I guess, and thought I would stay a couple months and then go to another city and sort of just kind of, you know, get India out of my system, in a sense. You know, you kind of feel like you just got to do India the way other people had. But I ended up staying for several years and just sort of kind of rooted myself in Bangalore for a few years and I happened to sort of stay with this one ad agency, Ogilvy & Mather, which is a big firm. And, you know, the main text, if you only read one book when you're getting into advertising, it's David Ogilvy's book, what is it called? Notes from the Advertising Man, I think. It's sort of a seminal text. And so, you know, David Ogilvy was this legend in the business. And so I joined up O&M in Bangalore. It's on, it was on MG Road, at least.
MG
and
Road,
yeah, and Mahalakshmi Chambers. And so it was, you know, the time I got there just happened to be sort of perfect because that's when India's economy was really beginning to liberalize in the 90s.
Right.
And so I it was an exciting time. I happened to be there with a great bunch of people. And advertising in one sense, you know, it can seem like it's a very sort of a, you know, a lot of these accounts might be very sort of like big American or Western accounts that are landing there. And, you know, some of them might be very much aimed at like the upper echelon society. But in other ways, you're really connecting with what do people want? You know, what do Indian people want? You know, and that might be what does somebody who needs an IBM want in their office? But, and that might seem like a very globalized kind of thing. But sometimes you're selling tea essentially to somebody who can only afford one tea bag.
Right.
The whole day. And so you're really dealing with some, you know, mass consumption and you know, what is the common, the regular average Indian want. And so it was actually a pretty great exposure and sort of education in all of these things.
So how do you get back to the United States then?
So at some point, I think everybody was like, wait, so are you ever moving back here? And I was like, well, I don't know. I mean, I guess why not? You know, it was very much, I didn't really have any sense of direction. I mean, I'd had this good job for a few years as a copywriter. I got to enjoy that, but I knew it wasn't really my ultimate destination. So then I kind of decided, well, let me give it a shot in the movie business. And so I worked on one film production on the set of a film production, and it was Deepa Mehta's film, Earth.
Yeah.
It's also called, I think it was called 1947 in the Indian market. And so I went and lived up north for several months in New Delhi and was sort of an AD or, you know, assistant director or PA, whatever you call it, on that. And, you know, it was another experience. I mean, it's a very tough job to be working on a film production. It's very grueling. You have weird hours. There's a lot of demands, a lot of egos. You know, you might be doing some really fun stuff for one scene, and then the next moment you're sort of trying to secure the perimeter, meaning you're trying to tell people, like regular people who are not involved in any way in the film production, that they need to shut up while the shoot is happening. And you're in New Delhi, and you're working in these really nice neighborhoods occasionally, and when you have to tell traffic, sorry, you can't go through, and please be quiet, do not honk your horns, and don't shout right now, and you're telling these you know, VVVIPs, and they get out of the car, and they're like, you have any idea who I am? I'm like, oh, sorry, sir. So sorry. Just 20 more seconds, 10 more seconds. Wait, actually, you know what? Two more minutes. I'm sorry. Please be quiet. I'm so. And they look like they are really almost willing to come and just like smack you around because the audacity of. Yeah. And so it was kind of a funny and challenging experience. But of course, the subject matter, this movie that's set in 1947, was really pretty fascinating. And, you know, it was a great experience. But then after that, I decided, well, I guess I'll move back to America. And I landed up in New York, you know, with just a suitcase and, you know.
Back home.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and so that was, that's where it started.
Wow. You came full circle. And so tell me, how did you get into NPR?
It took a few years, actually. After kind of stumbling about for a couple years, you know, I mean, my first job in New York City was paying $150 a week. And that was in the good weeks, I think. And I realized that wasn't for me. I mean, the film business, the independent film business specifically, is just like, you know, it's a really kind of a, it's a pretty awful business to get into. And when you're in your 20s and you kind of push around, and then I kind of stumbled about, got into, then the .com era happened, and I joined this website, which was sort of like launching called IndiaInfo.com. Hmm. And that was based in, like, Edison, New Jersey. And it was really kind of a, you know, sort of fly by night, but it was definitely not the most well thought out operation. I mean, I remember the inventory business, like the e-business model, like people were like, oh, look, now I can, my cousin in Hyderabad can, if he wants to give my daughter a gift, say he wants for her graduation, and he wants to buy her a Ganesha statue or something like that, some kind of gift or whatever, or for mm-hmm. his sister, he can do that. This is this amazing new revolution in retail or whatever, and in commerce. And I remember getting in the car, be like, oh, it's lunchtime, and one of the people from the website, we'd all jump into the car and go to the store and buy a Ganesha statue and then take it to the post office and put it in the mail. And it felt so crude and complete. I was like, what is going on here? Is this really your fulfillment model? And, you know, but it was my first sort of like stepping into the media in a sense. And I kind of wrote and edited articles aimed at the Indian American. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of fun. And then that connected me to India Abroad. But I was kind of stumbling for a few years writing freelance articles for various publications, Indian as well as – I wrote for Outlook magazine in India as well as papers and magazines here. And then finally I got into India Abroad, and I was there for a couple years actually, and I was writing sort of these longer feature articles for the diaspora. And it was actually a very fulfilling job, and I had a really great editor in Prem Panikkar, who is, you know, I guess he's very well known as an authority on cricket, but he's also just an excellent writer. I learned from him. He would give me books with some of the best journalism because he just wanted me to sort of like, you know, absorb his own love mm-hmm. for journalism. And so that was a really sort of important phase. And also thinking about these larger issues of identity and the Indian presence in America. I mean, when I grew up, when I was little and India Abroad came to our, you know, our house and it sat on our coffee table, I remember the articles about like, oh, you know, this girl made a 1540 on her SAT and that kid is a valedictorian. Right. And these were the sense of achievement, you know. But as the diaspora grew, the bar was raised for you to be sort of covered. You couldn't just be getting good grades. You had to be, you know, you saw the progressive sort of like the elevation of the standards for this community that was doing very well. And so before, you know, by the time I was getting there, it was, you know, we were talking about these Rhodes Scholars and people who are these entrepreneurs, the startups and making, you know, the Sabir Bhatia selling off Hotmail and that kind of a thing. But also asking really challenging questions about, you know, who are we in this in the overall racial and ethnic landscape of this country? You know, how do we feel about affirmative action? You know, where do we stand in that debate, which was kind of mm-hmm. raging when I was on the staff at India Abroad, and issues of gender and sexuality? You know, look, this couple in Washington, they're both Indian and they're both women and they got married to each other, you know, and had to, you know, and so it was kind of exciting to be there. And I was getting involved in SAJA, the South Asian Journalists Association, at the same time, which was a very, you know, important networking group, which still exists and does a very important job of connecting aspiring journalists with, you know, more senior journalists, but also helping frame these big issues. And this is my entry point towards public radio. I was on some panel discussion at Maharaja Restaurant in Midtown Manhattan.
Yeah.
And somebody approached me and, you know, she said, oh, my son is a radio producer. He needs some help reaching reporters who tell stories about immigrant communities in New York.
Yeah.
Before long, I was helping out with this initiative. It was called Feet in Two Worlds, and it was a program to tell public radio audiences about immigrant communities. And so, you know, one thing led to another, and suddenly I work for WNYC, which is the NPR station here in New York City, and it's been around since like 1924, I think.
No, that's fantastic. Great and fascinating conversation, Arun. Let's take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Thank you.
Hello again, everyone. This is M.R. Rangaswamy with Indiaspora Radio. I'm back here with Arun Venugopal, who's the host and creator of Micropolis. So, Arun, we were just talking about how you were approached by someone to kind of focus on these issues, and you joined WNYC, which obviously everyone in the U.S. knows is a premier, you know, public service and public station. So how did Micropolis get created?
You know, it took actually several years, MR, after I joined WNYC. I joined in 2005. This is my 10th year I've been here at WNYC. Initially, my boss and the editors, they said, you know, we want you to be what's called a general assignment reporter. You kind of do anything and everything.
Right.
And I liked that, the variety. You know, I did cover, say, the mayor, Mayor Bloomberg, for several years. I followed him and reported on that, but also did other stories, you know, culture and various things. And but several years after joining, I realized, you know, we live in this incredibly fascinating city, maybe the most interesting city in the world. I mean, I think many of us, at least, who live here, we feel that way. But I didn't think we were doing justice to it. I mean, there's such an incredible diversity, you know, whether it's class or religion or culture, race, everything, you know. And so it's this incredible laboratory of human life, and it really is. And it's this great, amazing, ongoing experiment in how do people from different backgrounds coexist, you know. And I didn't think we were quite capturing that that vitality or that essence of the city. And that's when Micropolis sort of like was born. It was sort of an effort, as the name kind of suggests, to sort of like zero in on these, you know, corners of the city and corners of, like, you know, the experience of urban life here in New York City, and kind of penetrating beyond just the surface. And it is also kind of true to what I had been interested in, which is sort of like, you know, these, you know, how you might experience, you know, even in the same neighborhood, say Jackson Heights in Queens, it's famous for being this incredibly diverse neighborhood. But what people don't realize unless you go there is that you can be there on, you know, a given day and you'll see the immense sort of breadth from, you know, this very vibrant LGBT community, you know, drag queens, you know, going to the bars over on Roosevelt Avenue. But you can also see women in burqas who've come over from Afghanistan or Bangladesh. And so that is the amazing sweep. And so how do people preserve these different sort of like ways of life? How do they come into contact with each other? You know, what are the frictions that happen for immigrants? You know, what is it like to be an African-American person living in Harlem, your 19-year-old man? And, you know, what is that contact with law enforcement, with the authorities, all those kinds of things? So, you know, all the issues we see raging at the national level, you see all those things playing out in New York City in any given neighborhood.
Yeah, so as you're covering this, I mean, you've done things like, you know, covering issues about turbans and skin lighteners and so on and so forth. Any one or a few seminal moments that you've covered over the past 10 years? I agree with you. I think New York is a microcosm of society as we know it in the United States and probably globally. So are there some seminal moments you can look back over the past 10 years and kind of go, wow, I was there when X happened?
Oh, yeah. Well, let's think. I mean, I was there at the beginning of Occupy Wall Street, which was kind of just great luck. It was a Sunday. I was reporting on something completely inconsequential in the financial district, just a couple blocks from Wall Street.
Yeah,
and it was some ridiculous press conference happening on the street. It was like some gentleman's club or something like that that was trying to protest some sort of, you know, new law having to do with their advertising. And so it was this owner of some gentleman's club, you know, basically a strip club, who was trying to, you know, and he kind of brought out three or four of his, you know, performers, these dancers, as they go, like, you know, these women who are sort of flanking him. And it was just kind of like, oh, I can't believe I'm here at this press conference. And suddenly, out of nowhere, this huge swarm of people just kind of like marches by. And I'm like, what is this? And luckily, this press conference I was covering was wrapping up. So I'm like, all right, I'm out of here. And I just kind of covered this, you know, it was probably several dozen people. And I'm like, what's going on here? And they were holding signs. And it was this brand new thing called Occupy. And you know, we marched around, or I marched around with them, or I covered them marching around, and that was day two of Occupy Wall Street. And anybody who's ever been associated with Occupy Wall Street, at least the first couple of years, they, as a point of pride, they always say, "Oh, I've been here since day 11 or
right.
since day 21." And I always love saying, "Well, I've been here since day two." It was almost like I'm
yeah.
almost I was there almost at the very
yeah.
very beginning,
yeah.
and it was an extraordinary thing to witness, because within days you saw that it had sort of like seized the national attention of like, who are these people
mm-hmm.
who are camping out in the middle of the financial district in lower Manhattan, and you know, how is the city going to kind of cope with this? What's the NYPD going to do? How is the mayor, this billionaire, how is he going to relate to
yeah.
this? And what do they want? You know, what do these people want? Because they had all these different signs saying different things. And so there was this cacophony, and I think people didn't take it seriously because there were so many competing messages. But at the heart of it, you realize there were certain themes. And so it was very exciting to cover that day to day, to report on that for NPR, for WNYC, to go on PBS and try to tell America
yeah.
what these people seem to want. And when you think about all the phrases that have become sort of part of our national lexicon, like the 1%, you know, and issues of inequality,
mm-hmm.
a lot of that really goes back to those initial days of Occupy Wall Street, when they sort of seized this momentum and really started telling, you know, America, listen, there's a huge problem here. It's a problem we've all kind of known under the surface, but here we're trying to make sure that people that we cannot be ignored anymore. So I was there then, and then just a few blocks from there, there was, of course, this huge issue of the Ground Zero Mosque, as it's
yeah.
kind of be known, you know, and it was another issue that, you know, I think at first people didn't quite know that it would be such a huge international controversy, but
mm-hmm.
I've been covering issues about Islam and Muslim life in America for many years, and that was perhaps the most sort of, I guess, intense one, because you had this real sense of fear and all kinds of rumor mongering about, like,
mm-hmm.
who are these people, this dangerous imam, you know, and it was a very sort of a fascinating and unsettling sort of an episode to cover, but it was also, you know, as a reporter, it was also really compelling, and it was a very satisfying experience to be there and to be able to try to explain this to the mm-hmm. world.
Well, that's amazing. You've covered so many fascinating stories, but the one more recent one that caught a lot of attention within our community was this whole episode and discussion around eating with your hands, which, as all of us Indian Americans know, I mean, was something that's just normal in India. And that seemed to have touched a chord. And take me through that. How did you even think of writing about that? And then I know you had a dinner, which, by the way, I didn't get invited to, which I'm told was a fascinating dinner conversation as well. So take us through that, because I think for our audience here, that would be a fascinating episode.
Yeah, you know, I think that it's the idea of how we as Indians eat with our hand, our fingers. You know, it's something, of course, I did growing up, and I don't remember a time when I didn't. My parents, this is how they taught me, and this is how they fed me, of course, with their own hand, you know. And many years ago, actually, when I was early, in my early days as a journalist, I remember pitching this idea to an Indian editor, and I remember he was kind of dismissive. So for many years, this idea kind of lay buried. And at some point, about a year and a half ago, I brought it up with an editor here. I think my editor, Karen, said, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, what are the things that we were talking about in an upcoming series of stories, Micropolis stories, and, you know, what are the important racial stories that need to be told, race and ethnicity? And she said, are there any things about you that you think, you know, you were uncomfortable or awkward about? I was like, oh, yeah, of course. I forgot about this whole one story, this one
yeah.
issue. And so then we thought, well, we could do a radio story, but it's not really. It's more like a video, isn't it? And we
mm-hmm.
do have video producers here, even though we're a radio station. You know, we're, I guess, like many other places, we're a multimedia news outlet now. And so that's what we shot. And so they thought, like, the producer thought, well, we're not going to just do this in some room or an office. Let's actually take this to the public. Because basically what you're saying is that you're an Indian American, you have grown up doing this, but you were always embarrassed about it. So why don't we actually take this out into the public so you can sort of show the world and kind of come out of the closet, so to speak, you know, with this habit. And, you know, I remember in high school, you know, I knew people in high school and even earlier than that who I was really wary. I was really anxious that if they came over to my home, they would see that we ate like this. So I kind of avoided calling some of them over. And so I kind of talked about that. And so one day we went to Wall Street. We went into this indoor sort of a this huge hall. It's sort of a public atrium of sorts. And I packed a tiffin carrier with some chettinad food. I got it from a restaurant. It was like various dishes, some fish curry and all these other things. And I opened up this tiffin carrier in this public space on a table. And we videotaped this, me opening this up. And, you know, you had other people kind of walking by, kind of looking at this curious scene that was unfolding. And we, you know, I talked to the camera about how you do this. You know, I tried to explain to the audience, like, the appeal of this, also the awkwardness if you're an Indian growing up in America, in the West. And, you know, you can go to any restaurant and almost 100% of the people are not going to be eating with their hand. They eat with utensils. And so that's a very strange thing because we know that's not necessarily how we want to do it. Often you're like, we know, you know, like if you really want to like enjoy that food, if it's rice especially and all that stuff, you know, you don't want to be using a spoon or a fork. And so it was sort of explaining the allure of this, the appeal, but also about the awkwardness of it and the sort of the shame factor if you did grow up in America and you didn't want. Now my daughter, she's grown up in Queens and she's completely comfortable because I think I don't know, maybe either she has more self-esteem than I did at her age, or she just grows up in a very diverse place where it's not unusual to express yourself, your culture. You know, it's sort of like all things are equal in that sense. But when the video came out, I was really struck by the response. I had, you know, I would go to like get-togethers, parties, and you know, you'd have uncles and aunties who'd be like, Arun, you know, thank you so much. And I actually thought they were kind of joking at first because it just felt like a fun thing. But you know, I think it did capture for a certain generation something very important about, you know, as Indians, we've come here. Many people in our community have done very well. They've been very successful, and that's sort of the driving narrative of who we are. But there are still some things that we have not been able to do with complete ownership. You know, we have, you know, and something like this, it might seem kind of trivial, you know, eating with your hand, but it sort of speaks to something else about, you know, centuries of like our contact with the West, with the British, and then coming here, our contact with Americans, and the aspects of our identity which we don't feel comfortable about or we feel sort of embarrassed about. And I think for them, they thought, you know, I came here 45 years ago, some of them would tell me, and we were always so embarrassed about this. And so, you know, it was, I guess, touching for me to hear that and to think that I'd sort of played some sort of role in that conversation.
That was fantastic. I can see a new series for you, Arun, where you kind of do this on a national basis, you know, take your eating with your hands dinner program across the U.S.
Oh, yeah. I would love to. Hey, any excuse to eat, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's fantastic. So you seem to have such a fascination for human life and what goes on and so forth. So how does someone like you, what do you do to relax or do things outside of observing humanity?
Well, you know, we have a very, you know, great bunch of friends in a community we've developed in Jackson Heights and Queens and New York in general. And, you know, that's what's been so rewarding about living here. It's not just that we're exposed to all this fun stuff about New York, but we have a real community. And we have a bunch of people who actually are journalists, Desi Indian journalists who from Saja and outside of that, you know, people who are academics, who are you know, filmmakers and nonprofit activists doing really important work. And so, you know, that's the crowd that we kind of like hang out with and that my daughter has grown up around. And we love getting together and eating and cooking and exploring Jackson Heights and Queens. I mean, a couple days ago we had a couple friends over and And another person who I'd never met before, but she's visiting New York from Paris, and she's a grown up in Paris, but she's a Moroccan background. She's helping me with, I'm going to Paris in a few days for a few weeks. I'll be there reporting on the issue of Muslims living in Paris at this moment in history, and she's helping me with that. And so we thought, like, you know, come on over for dinner. And we had dinner at our place. My wife made some chicken curry and other things, and it was mm-hmm. really great. And then after that, we walked to Woodside, which is an adjacent neighborhood, and we had this fantastic, it was a Filipino restaurant which makes this crazy purple yam ice cream. It's this purple ice cream, and it's got all these other kinds of toppings, and it's this very unusual and really delicious thing. And so, you know, that was like 9:45 at night. We walked over there, and they gave us a few orders of this, and we sat around and enjoyed that. And so, you know, that's like the kind of thing that you wouldn't get anywhere else in the world, you know, purple yam ice cream. So that's the kind of thing we enjoy doing, and, you know, movies and that kind of stuff. And so, yeah, we love the city.
Great. Well, fantastic. Arun, this has been a fascinating conversation, to say the least, and you brought attention to so many things that we observe every day but wanted to talk about or found it difficult to address. And I think you've done such an amazing job. So thank you so much for being on our show.
Well, thank you, Amara. It's been a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Diaspora Radio is produced by Monica Patel. The theme music is by our very own Rina Ismail. The interlude music is by Jahan Shah. So long, everyone.